Welcome to Leverage Masters, airing weekly on Tuesdays at 12 Eastern and on demand on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio. Leverage Masters hosts Jack Humphrey and Gina Gaudio-Graves discuss leverage strategy with guest leveragists. Be sure to subscribe to Leverage Masters in your favorite podcatcher for great tips and case studies on using leverage to achieve your biggest goals much faster.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of Leverage Masters. I am your co-host, Gina Gaudio-Grace, the co-founder of Divizio, the affiliate network for companies doing good. And we have got a fantastic show lined up for you today. I don't know what's going on with tech, but it's not letting me into the panel to unmute everybody. Yeah, bear with me. I'm trying to get in there. What the heck is going on? If you're in there, Andrea, if you want to unmute yourself and our guest, that would be fantastic. What I can tell you is that we have my executive producer and co-host, Andrea Adams-Miller, the founder of the Red Carpet Connection, joining us. And we have got a stellar guest for you guys today. Let's see if this is my internet connection instead of... There we go. Now it's working. I think I got you guys unmuted, Andrea.
Oh, hello. Andrea Adams-Miller here. Well, it's been really fun all over the world. The crazy things are happening, and I mean fun both realistically, there's fun happening in the world. Unfortunately, a lot of the fun, if you guys can mute yourselves, because we have a lot of background noise right now, if you guys can mute yourselves. We have in the world, obviously, a lot going on. COVID's going on. There's riots going all over from the recent things that are going on in the world. And we want to make sure that we amplify your world. We want to help leverage what's going on in your world so that you can be thinking about positive things and make a positive impact so that you can overcome the challenges that are presented in front of you and really leverage yourself to the highest levels possible. And Gina, you were right about us having a great guest. Right now I'm getting a lot of really loud feedback from someone's mic, so I don't know if both of you can mute yourselves while I read the bio. And
I was already
a little bit better.
Andrea.
So it must be Michael's that's really. Can you mute his for a moment? Hey, everybody. I already kind of gave it away. His name is Michael, so now you all get to guess. Which Michael in the world could it be? Which Michael? Well, it's Michael Mann, and he has been in the entertainment industry since age 5. As a young child, Michael entered the business as a model, which led him to become one of the pioneers in live television. I need to interrupt the bio here. One of our guests is making, or one of our production assistants is making a lot of noise in the background, and they have a really good mic that's picking up everything, which I am so glad that they do. And we're just going to muddle through here, but I wanted to make sure our audience listeners have an ease on their ears because that was really super loud. So let me start over. We have Michael Mann with us. He has been in the entertainment industry since age 5. As a young child, Michael entered the business as a model, which led him to become one of the pioneers in live television. In 1975, he moved to Los Angeles to continue his acting career, and he worked with many notable actors, Carol O'Connor, Billy Crystal, Rob Reiner, Penny Marshall, Burt Reynolds, Clint Eastwood, Danny DeVito, and in 78, he formed Michael Mann Management, a theatrical management company representing actors, writers, directors, production designers, and directors of photography, and in 81, he produced Come Blow Your Horn, starring Elliot Gould, at the Huntington Hartford Theater in L.A., and then he returned to New York in 1994, producing two Broadway plays, Boychuk at the Theater and Innocent Flesh at the Actors Temple, and in 2010, he relocated to Atlanta to produce a feature film entitled On Smoother Dirt. It's the life of the great Chicago Cubs icon, Ernie Banks, and then we'll produce a two-hour pilot episode of a new series in Dublin, Ireland. The remaining episodes will be shot in Atlanta, as will The Odyssey of Bobby Summers, so we'll hear more about that, too. And it's the greatest productions of his life, have been his 6 children and his 12 grandchildren. I am so excited to have Michael here with us. He's done some really cool stuff. Michael, yay! Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you. Michael, can you hear us? Hi, Michael. Welcome to the programming.
Thank you, Andrea. Can you hear me okay? Everybody hear me okay?
We can. Sometimes
excellent.
We just have to deal with the technologies of the world. We're very fortunate that we can still be on today. Yesterday, because of the riots going on in different areas, the internet was completely wiped out in a mass system area, and multiple people that I knew that were on programming had to shut down. So I am fortunate today, and I know our audiences, that we get to listen to you and hear about you. So, you know, one of the things people don't realize, you know, I said that you were in the entertainment industry and you worked with these people on live television, but it doesn't reveal actually what they might recognize you from. So would you share about that? Like what programming were you on that people might go, oh my gosh, I know who he is now?
Well, I think the things that I will probably be most recognized for is I did 6 All in the Families. The first one I did was in 1975. And it was Billy Crystal's first episode on the show. And I played the minister who married Billy at Rob and Sally's home on New Year's Eve. That was the first of 6 All in the Families I did. The following year, I did a vasectomy on Rob Reiner. And then the third character I played the following year was a rabbi when they found out that Stephanie was Jewish. And Archie and Edith come to see me because Archie can't believe she's Jewish. And then I became the resident rabbi when the show became Archie Bunker's Place. That's probably the most recognizable numerous characters I played. And then in my film package, I was in the original movie of Smokey and the Bandit in 1976.
So let's go back to All in the Family. So actually, that's really pertinent to like what's going on in the world. I remember watching that show growing up, and so here we have Archie Bunker, who's set in his ways. You know, he's very condescending and demeaning to Edith and to his family members and to his son-in-law, and obviously he has discomfort with race, you know. So what was it like to be on a controversial show like that?
Well, it was a real trendsetter. They broke through barriers on that show that had never been addressed before in that medium. And it was very, it was extraordinary. And it was a pleasure to be on the show. And I feel that all 3 subjects that were dealt with were very important. For instance, on the vasectomy show, when Sally sends him off and calling him a bleeding heart liberal because he won't get a vasectomy and he won't bring any more children in the world. When the show was written and we all sat around the table, at the end, the producers felt that they copped out because at the end he went to get the vasectomy and didn't get it. And they said, no, you can't do that. And then when the show aired after we did it, where he did get the vasectomy, I think over 2,000 vasectomies were reported within the next month or so. It was crazy, crazy. So a lot of influence the show had on America and around the world.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. What would you think would happen if that show were to be airing nowadays with what's going on in the world?
Well, it's still airing it, so you can find it all over the place on YouTube and stuff. I think it would be a different kind of show now. I think there would be shows that are dealing with the situations a little differently now. The thing that was interesting about All in the Family is that they could make a very big political point and a social point, but then they could disarm you with great laughter, and it was a great combination of seriousness and comedy. It really made it probably one of the greatest shows ever on television. There was an episode I remember that I wasn't on called Edith's Surprise Party, and it was a two-parter, a two-hour or two half-hours, and it was basically Edith, Archie had agreed to have a surprise party for Edith's 50th, I can't remember, birthday, and they gathered everybody over at Sally and Rob's home, and she was home alone, And she, a doorbell rings, and an actor named David Duke, may he rest in peace, a wonderful actor, comes in posing as a policeman. And he says he's there to question her. And the next thing you know, he's trying to rape her. And, you know, Edith, of all people, right?
Wow.
So he actually starts to attempt to rape her. And just as he's starting to, she becomes Edith again. And he goes, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? And he jumps up and she runs out the door to Sally and Rob's apartment and opens the door and everybody's yelling, surprise, it was a birthday party for her. So they were able to deal with something that important and then disarm you with humor. It was amazing.
Wow. So quite interesting in writing. Archie, as a real person, what was he like for real? Because, you know, so many times people take an actor and that's who they think they are in real life. Was he anything like his character, or was he really just a really great actor?
Carol O'Connor, in all my years in the business, and as I said, I've been in the business all my life, and I put him in a handful of people who are one of the nicest, generous, decent human beings I ever met in my life. Couldn't be further from the character he played on the show. Sincere, intelligent, caring, really, truly a real gentleman. I really, it was an honor to work with him.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. And go ahead.
And I had worked with Gene Stapleton earlier on in my career as a child actor. I was in the original company of Damn Yankees on Broadway, and so I knew Gene from those days as well. So it was a real connection for me with Gene. We go back to when I was a kid, and she was stage managing a show I was doing for the American Theater Wing, which she slept me on the subway. And we go do these shows at children's schools. I was must have been 8 or 9 years old. So Gina and I had a real history together. It was great.
Yeah, that is super fun. I had told you before when we talked that I did a community theater production of Damn Yankees, and absolutely love the show. And the choreography they did for our guys in the ball field, you know, was super fun. And I had to fill in for one of them for a space one night. And so I had to learn the whole dance so that way everybody could have, you know, placement correctly for choreography. And to do hitch kicks was so hard. But, yeah, I love that you were in that show. It's a great show. I love Damn Yankees.
I didn't open in it because my voice changed. I was one of the Joe Hardy fan club, and I couldn't sing the top harmony anymore. So I didn't open in the show, but I was definitely part of it when we rehearsed it. And then Gene and I hooked up later on in life.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And how was that, you know, to have been given a role for a show and then to be rejected because you went through puberty, you know, and although it wasn't personal to you, it probably felt really personal to you.
Well, at 12 or 13 years old, you know, I was hired and sang for and was hired by the great director, George Abbott, one of the greats in Broadway history. So obviously I was good enough to get the part over, God knows how many thousands of kids. And when we reached rehearsal, I just couldn't sing, you know, the time span from when I got hired till we were, you know, getting ready to open, you know, out of town. I just couldn't sing the harmony anymore. I couldn't sing the top. And so my understudy replaced me, who was my understudy also in another series, another play I did on Broadway with Betty Davis a few years earlier. So it bothered me a great deal because as a kid, you're vulnerable anyway. And I'm in a business, you know, surrounded by competition, but it bothered me. But I got through it, and I went on to do some wonderful things after that too. But at the time, it bothered me, but not now. I look at it as a growing experience.
So for some reason, the only song I can think of is "You Gotta Have Heart, Miles and Miles
That's
and Miles
correct.
Of Heart."
Exactly. That's what we used to sing. Gene say, okay, boys, let's sing. And we'd all go, you got to have heart. We'd all have to sing. It was the Joe Hardy fan club. We're singing the same song that the ballplayers were singing in the dugout, you know. Great song.
Oh, fun.
Song.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So so then after theater and you were doing all those other things where you said you'd be on the subway and going different places, then how did things change for you then? What happened for you and what occurred for you differently then after that? How'd the transition
go? I kept working. I went to a school called the Professional Children's School, which was a school that was founded in 1913 for children of performers like burlesque and vaudeville and radio, and where they had to be on the road all the time. Milton Berle went to that school because he traveled, and it was a school for performing people, either children of people who were on the road or performing, or actual performers in all the performing arts. It wasn't a school like performing arts where you went to learn drama or dance. This was a school set up specifically so you could be on the road or wherever and still get your work in and not have to be in school. So I went to that school all my life, and my lifelong friends from that, as a matter of fact, one of my dearest friends, today would have been his birthday, and I miss him dearly, was the great, great lyricist and composer Marvin Hamlisch. Today would have been Marvin's birthday, and I knew Marvin since he was 10 or 11 years old.
And what kind of music did he compose so that we can help the audience identify with what he was part of again?
Well, he wrote The Way We Were. He wrote Chorus Line. He wrote The Sting. And he started out, his first successful song when he was a young boy was for Leslie Gore, a song called Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows. That was his first kind of pop song. And but I knew he was writing songs when he was 10, 11 years old from my classmate, a wonderful African-American a young man named Josh White Jr., whose father, Josh White Sr., was the greatest folk singer that ever lived. And Marvin was writing songs for Josh, my classmate, he was 10, 11, 12 years old. So that's where I grew up. That was my home, my playground. And I still have lifelong friends from that experience that I'm very close to right now, who are still with us.
Yeah.
So made it. Yeah, it was like a very special place. And I went all through high school there. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that just is a beautiful, memory. And I recognize his name, but I'm not always the best at putting together names with the name of the title of a song. Like sometimes I know lyrics of songs, but I don't know the title.
Right.
So thank you for reminding me and our audience that, because when you hear, The Way We Were, Jiminy Christmas,
yeah.
What an impact he made in the world with
Marvin
that song.
I was in California in 1972. I'd gone out to re-pursue my acting, and Marvin was out there working, and he was renting an apartment there. And I went over, and he, in his apartment, said, "Hey, Mike, I want you to hear this job I just got. I just beat Michelle Legrand out for the score." And he said, "There's no lyricist even put on it yet." And he played for me for the first time ever the melody to The Way We Were. And I said, "This is it, Marv. This is it, kiddo. This is the one." And sure enough, yeah, it was.
What a great memory for you to be able to have and to share and to be privy to, history and have, something behind the scenes like that happening in your world. And to me, that just is so exciting. The only kind of cool things that I can reference is Frank Shankwitz. He's the founder of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. When he... they have a movie that came out about him last year called Wish Man. And we took his story for the Keep Smiling movement, similar to what we're doing with you, Michael, is, we took your story and we're writing it for the Keep Smiling movement for you to co-author one of the books. And doing Frank's story, I already knew the backstory. So then when we watched the film and I see the story, happening on the film, I was so excited because there were things I knew that they adjusted and made different for on the screen, different than the real story. And being a part of that was really exciting. So that's my only comparison, which, you know, so but the idea of you being behind and knowing and like hearing the way we were for the first time and then having, you know, the you know, who sang it and who did it, you know, just blows me away. That's super, super exciting.
Yeah, I have a lot of stories like that that we'll talk about for the ebook about people I encountered and worked with, because I worked with some real giants in the business and just personal anecdotes about who they were. I played Perry Como's son. Perry Como has three children, two boys and a girl, and in the 50s, and he never wanted his children, even back then, to be exposed on television. So they hired three actors to play his two kids. And I got to play, David's Perry's son on television. So Perry, you know, things like that, silly stuff. But he was very protective of his family, even back then. So they hired three actors and nobody ever said a word. That's great.
Oh, that's interesting. So what was it like to play his son?
Well, Perry Como is in that list of one of the most human, sweet, decent human beings I ever met in my life. He was very, very, very gentle, very calm, and it was great. You know, I'm the only person in the world who can say I played David Como. You know? Even David Como.
Yeah.
I never actually met the kids. No, because they never came around. But, I mean, he'd remember who I was, obviously, because I played him. And I was probably around 13 or 14 years old.
Okay, so this is going to sound really funny, but I actually have a story that can go with that. My ex-husband, who is now living with me again, dated Melanie Como, who is David's daughter, for many years. And we just talked to Melanie like 2 days ago on the telephone.
Well, when you talk to is David still alive, I hope, and Ronnie, her uncle? Good. Well,
Correct. Please
send my best regards back and ask them if they remember, if David remembers growing up watching me play him on TV with his dad.
I will definitely have to do that for you, Michael. Isn't
what
that too
small,
funny?
What a small world.
Small world.
I actually have a picture of me with David, playing David with the two other actors who played his other children. Let's see, it was Beverly Lunsford played his daughter and Bobby Galley played his other brother. I actually have a picture of the four of us, which maybe we'll put in the ebook, Andrea.
That would be a great
Fantastic.
Thing to do.
Yeah, I have some wonderful pictures from the. I was very blessed that my mom made sure that we got stills of a lot of things I did. So I have a tremendous amount of stuff from my youth.
Oh, it sounds fun. Those are the kind of things that people just really enjoy and that love the historical reference to them and takes them back into their life. And then now because television is featuring shows from the past and so forth, we get to see things that we thought we'd never get to see, you know, again. And I know like different shows like MeTV and so forth and, you know, how these different shows pop up and we can you know, see things that our parents and grandparents were in, things when you were a little boy and so forth. And I think that's just really fun because it gives us a chance to look back at an era where things were looked at different, values were different, time and family were set up differently, and just gives us a chance to explore how people lived. And so I love that.
It's good. Me too.
Yeah. All right, so all that was happening, and then you make this, to me it seems sudden, a sudden leap, a switch into management. And so what led you to do that? And how old were you when you switched over?
Well, there was an interim chunk of time, which we haven't discussed yet. If you have time, I can give you a thumbnail sketch.
Sure.
After high school, my parents were divorced, and I was kind of a I would say precocious, but nice young man who thought the world revolved around me. And my aunts and uncles on my mother's side, my parents were divorced. thought that I needed some discipline in my life because I was basically in charge. So they had a big meeting, family meeting, and said, Michael, you need to go into the military at 17 and a half years old, 1959. And I sat there thinking, what's going on here, whatever. And they said, pick one to go to. And naively, I picked the Navy because I didn't want to be in the Army, and I didn't know if I wanted to fly or not. And so I went into the Navy. So I was in the Navy from June of 59 till the first week in February of 63. So I was my 18th, 19th, and 20th birthday, I spent in the Navy. So when I got out the day before my 21st birthday in 63, I kind of came back to the world and had to figure out what I was going to, you know, do with myself. So I went back into the business and started working back in television, called some people who were my agents. I did an episode, a couple of episodes of Secret Storm, where I played a dope dealer with a young actor who was just getting started named Dustin Hoffman, and Dustin and I did a couple of episodes together. And then I kind of worked my way back into it, and then fell into, because of a friend of mine who was an investor, in a thing called discotheques, which were just coming to be in the 60s, in the early to mid-60s in New York. And I wound up running one of the most famous discotheques in New York and got segued away from the bar business. I mean, from the from show business. It wound up owning my own little club, and it was wild. It was pretty wild. And then one day, my dear friend Marvin Hamlisch wrote a play called The Chorus Line. And I went to see the first Frozen production. Do you know what that means when you say a show is frozen, Andrea, in theater?
I am a theater buff, and yet I've never heard that. And so now I'm like, oh, you've stumped me.
Well, what it is when you're in rehearsal or you're out of town, you're trying out, you pull a song, you put a song in, you move a song around or you cut it. And then at one point you do a performance and it's locked. That's it. That's it. This is the show we're taking opening with. And it's called Freezing the Show. And I saw the first Frozen production matinee of Chorus Line downtown before the world saw it. And I saw that and said to myself, what am I doing in the saloon business? You know, people holding up their, who am I my resume? And I said, what am I doing in the bar business? I've been in show business all my life, except for 3.5, 4, 5 years. So I made a decision to go to California, and I did. And I went out there and wound up doing a play called Mr. Roberts. That's a great television director, James Burrows, who created Cheers and Will and Grace and everything, directed me in. And then I moved out to California in 75. And that's when I start doing all those television shows. And then one day I decided that I couldn't get the proper representation I wanted. And I decided to start representing clients and becoming a manager. And my first client was a girl who went to PCS with me. Her name was Melinda Plank. And she was a classmate of mine. She was a soloist with the American Ballet Theater and had hurt herself and went into acting and was very successful on a soap opera. And I ran into her and her husband, and she said, manage me. And I produced the play. And next thing you know, in November 1st, 1975, I opened Michael Mann Management and did that for 43 years. Never looked back. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's fun. It's funny because, you know, in some ways I can relate to what you're talking about because I'm a speaker and I go on stage and I was on like CNN in 2020 early in my career. And then now I'm a publicist. So now I'm promoting other people and getting them on stage and getting them on radio and television shows. And I still do get on stage and I still do theater and stuff like that, as I can filter it in, but having that flip flop, it is really, I can imagine, and tell me if this is true that, so for me, I just get really excited about seeing other people's success and lifting them so high. Is that the same kind of excitement you get? It's like, you know, raising this wonderful person up to do their own thing, you know?
Exactly. For me, it was, if I wasn't going to be in the room, I wanted to put you in the room and be very involved in how it went. And since I had had all the training and I'd been in hundreds and hundreds of different auditions and on, I can't remember how many stages and sets, I felt, and I was, that was an asset that people came to me for because they knew I'd been an actor all my life. I'd also directed a few plays and written a screenplay. So they were very comfortable having me represent them because I had been in action and knew exactly what was going on. Either people whose careers I was rebuilding or brand new kids, you know, who just got out of school or just come to LA. So it was very, very rewarding for me. Very rewarding.
So give us some stories of, like, you know, who are some people that you represented and what are some things that happened that you maybe didn't expect to happen and came about and ended up being, you know, icons in history for us as far as the theater, or, well, I guess as far as film and television and theater.
Well, I you probably have a list of, I mean, I've represented thousands of people since 1975 till I closed my company 2 years ago to move to Atlanta to produce. But I would think that the names that you would probably know best would be a wonderful number one Native American actor in the world named Wes Studi. Wes starred in Last of the Mohicans, and he starred in Geronimo and Avatar, and he just won an honorary Academy Award last year. So Wes was a client of mine when Native American actors couldn't get any jobs. So he was married, is married to a woman named Maura Du, D-H-U, and her dad was the late, great Jack Albertson. I don't know if your listening audience will remember who Jack Albertson was, but Jack Albertson was the grandfather in Willy Wonka, and he was on a show on television in the 70s called, what was it, with Freddie Prinze. Just went out of my head. Chico and the Man.
I was saying Chico and the Man. I recognize him.
Right.
Yeah.
So Jack's daughter, Mara, was married to Wes, and she brought him to me because I had worked with Jack Albertson in 1956 when I was brought out to California to do a TV show. So I remained close with Jack. Jack brought Wes to me. He was in a movie called Powwow Highway. And then right after that, he was in Dances with Wolves, but he couldn't really get a lot of work because he would only be typecast as a Native American. So my namesake, Michael Mann, the director, the wonderful director, hired him for Last of the Mohicans to play Magua. And I went over and looked at the material. Michael showed me some of his footage before it was cut, and I went into business with Wes, and we did very well together, very well together.
Yeah, I definitely recognize him. Yeah.
A woman I represented for many years. Again, I represented Wes by myself. There was nobody else. It was me and a publicist. Mm. And because agents weren't interested then in representing a Native American actor, things have all changed now. So our success was Wes's talent and my perseverance, and we did very well together. Another person you wouldn't maybe know by name, but who was a client of mine for over 20-some-odd years, is an actress named Leslie Easterbrook. Leslie is most well-known for 6 of the 7 Police Academy movies that she starred in, and she was also on Laverne and Shirley as Rhonda for many years. So Leslie and I were together for 20-some-odd years.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Rhonda. Yeah.
Yeah, big, tall, blonde. Yeah, Leslie. Wonderful.
Yeah.
I represented Molly Shannon for a very, very short period of time because nobody would know what to do with Molly Shannon before Saturday Night Live came along. I represented Rachel Dratch. I represented Christopher Atkins. A lot of people that you probably have on the list that I don't have in front of me. But, you know, after thousands of years, we were very successful. I did very well. I'm very happy.
Yeah. So just for our listening audience, because not everybody recognizes names with, you know, characters and so forth. So Molly Shannon is from Saturday Night Live. So you guys might know her from, she's done multiple films as well. And some of her funny skit bits were was the girl who'd get nervous and stick her fingers in her armpits and then smell her hands.
Yeah.
You know, and funny.
Sister Cat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so she did all those funny things. And then what was the name that you mentioned after that?
Rachel Dratch, who was also on Saturday Night Live years later, a little cute little short little girl, very, very funny. She worked with Will Ferrell a lot. But most of the other people, excuse me, who I worked with were very prominent in television. Martin Cove, who was in the Karate Kid movies, Lou Gossett Jr. is a client of mine, who won the Academy Award for Officer and a Gentleman and Emmys for Roots. A lot of people. I don't have them in front of me, but if you have a list, you're welcome to rattle a few off and I can tell you about them. But it was an amazing journey.
So what is the story that you remember the most that, like you were surprised, like you didn't know that was going to happen or the movie was going to be that big or, you know, that it was going to be such a takeoff? What sticks out to you?
As something that was a good surprise?
Good or bad, you can go either direction.
Well, I met a young girl, a wonderful agent, called me one day. No names need to be spent here, but she was an agent at a big agency, and she had come over from another agency and said that they weren't allowed to bring that client with them, and she said, this is somebody you should know. So I said, look, if you think she's that good, I'll meet her. She came into my office. She hadn't worked in about 6 months, and I just thought she was really funny. She'd done a couple of little episodes, an episode of Cheers, a Remington Steele, a couple of things, but nothing substantial. She'd done the pilot of Barry, oh my goodness, I'm getting old, the Barry Levinson Diner. She'd done the pilot of Diner, which never got made. So we sat together and chatted, and I said, you're great. Let's go to work. She said, I'm with this agency, but they're doing nothing for me. And I said, well, let's begin. And I started working with her. And at that point, I'd had very good relationships, excuse me, with casting directors because I was an actor before that. So there were most of the casting directors who were just beginning their careers, I had either worked for or been in to see and were very helpful when I called them about meeting clients of mine. So there was a casting director named Sally Dennison who had cast me in a small role I did in a movie called The China Syndrome. And Sally was casting a new series at the beginning of when the Fox Network was actually beginning. The Fox Network, for all the people who are listening who are old enough to remember, was the fourth network. It didn't exist until, I don't know, 30 years ago. And they only had one night of programming to start, and there were only four shows on that night on a Sunday. One was Married with Children. The other was 21 Jump Street. The other was the Tracy Ullman Show. And the other one was this show that Sally was casting. And so I called Sally. They were doing 13 episodes, and there was a recurring role on of this woman who was a studio exec. And I called Sally and said, listen, I've just taken on this fantastic actress named Allison LaPlaca. And I said, Allison is brilliant and you should bring her in. She said, no, she's not right for this, Mike. She's not right for this. I said, Sally. She said, I've seen her before and she's got too much of an edge. She's not right. I said, well, Sally, that's not who she is. Did you ever think that she might have just come in as that character? Why don't you bring her in to read her? So they brought her in, and of course she got the part. It was two episodes of 13. And I went over to the run-through, and David Steinberg, the actor-director, was directing, and he called me aside because I knew him. He said, Mike, this is the next Mary Tyler Moore. She's brilliant. They went crazy for her. So long story short, they made a deal for her. She wound up being the star of the show. They spun her off to a show called Open House, which was Ellen DeGeneres' first TV show. And then she wound up starring on a show with John Larroquette. And we had an incredible run. And every time we wanted something to get better, they would call me. I didn't have to call them to make it better. So Allison LaPlaca was truly best feather in my cap, I think, as far as success from nowhere.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. She ended up doing Friends for a long time too, didn't she?
Oh yeah, she played Jennifer's boss, and then she got hit by
a car. 10 years or something. Oh, they killed
her. No, not that long. She got killed in a car. She was on her way back from a meeting and got hit in a taxi or something. But she was on Friends, correct? And then she did the pilot of Big. Of the movie, but never got on the air. And then she did the Lara Kitt show for a couple of seasons. And she just worked a great deal. And she was one of my favorite people, still is one of my favorite people.
Oh, so she actually was. I thought you were saying they killed her off in Friends. You're saying she actually was killed.
No. They killed her off on the show.
Oh, no.
They killed her off on the
show. Oh, okay. Whew. Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that because wait a minute. Okay. All right, good.
I'm glad to hear she's
safe. Alive and well. Glad to hear she's alive and well. Yeah, I recognize her a lot.
Yeah, those are the kind of stories that give me, as an ex-actor, real joy to take somebody, put them in a room, and have it explode, not just to get that part, but to spin her off into her own series. It was very fantastic, really fantastic.
That is very fantastic. So we should probably mention Don Most, who played Ralph Malf on Happy Days.
Correct.
And
I worked with Donnie. Donnie was a client of mine for years and years after Happy Days. Remember, I didn't start the management company till 75, and Happy Days was already up and running, and Donnie was off doing what he was doing. And Henry and Ronnie were all, they were all working. So I didn't come. Donnie and I started working together about in the early 90s. Lovely man, doing very well right now. He's also a very talented singer and a good golfer. We played a lot of golf together.
Oh, fun. Yeah, I remember their singing. I loved, it's fun for me talking to you because all the things that you're talking about is all the television program that we watch. So I was a only child, a lonely child, and besides books, there was TV because there wasn't kids in my neighborhood. And so we consumed a lot of television. The television was on all the time. And so I do remember these things and watching all of these things on Fox and so forth, like what you mentioned, which I had to laugh when you listed off the first three shows of Fox. I was like, oh my gosh, those are my three favorite television shows. So apparently who was picking the shows for Fox definitely fit the genre of shows that I enjoyed.
I love Tracy Ullman
because I love variety.
Right. Well, 21 Jump Street was where Johnny Depp started.
Yeah, yes, definitely remember that one.
And then Tracy Ullman's show, which was brilliant, is where The Simpsons came through. That was a sketch they did on, an animated sketch they did on Tracy Ullman. And then The Simpsons came out of that.
And look at it, it's still still watched. In fact, in my home... my husband loves The Simpsons so much. My husband owns a pinball and video game business, and so we own the older first model of the Simpsons game, the pinball machine, and then we own the new one, and then he had all the things decked out, so it has all the top LED lights and all the everything in it. It's definitely a collector's item. And then for Christmas one year, I heard that they had a Ren and Stimpy television. It's a little pink television that you could buy separately and incorporate that into your pinball machine that plays 50 episodes of Ren and Stimpy. And it's literally like 2 inches by 2 inches. It's this tiny little box television that cost me $250 inside of a pinball machine.
Wow. Amazing.
In our house, you're not allowed to speak to Tom between 8 and 8:30. The Simpsons is on.
Why is Gina being so quiet here? She only told me about Barry Como's granddaughter.
I know.
Do you have any questions?
I don't have any great stories to share.
Oh, okay. Well, do you have any questions? Do you have any questions you want to ask? I don't know how much more time.
Of all the people that you've been a part of their lives and their careers, who is your favorite and why?
My favorite person?
Yep. Your favorite client.
Besides
and
me.
Why?
You know, besides me.
No, client or client? Client or someone
client.
I worked with as an actor. Client.
Ooh, I'll take either one.
Well, I'd rather not pick a client because I had thousands of them, and a lot of them helped me put my kids through school. So I think if I pick one, that would be unfair to the other 35 who I loved. And some people came through my doors that were incredible. But I'd rather pick a couple of people who I worked with growing up that I loved. The first one is a name you'll never know unless there are people who are really theater buffs who grew up in New York. And his name was David Burns, or Davy Burns, as we would call him. I worked with Davy first in 1951, if you can count back that far, the ancient years, in a musical revue on Broadway called Two's Company, where Betty Davis starred on Broadway singing, if you can imagine Betty Davis singing on Broadway. And Davy and I did a sketch together that was absolutely brilliant. I worked with Davy there. I then worked with him on another show on Broadway called Hole in the Head with Paul Douglas and Lee Grant. And then we did the sketch in L.A. on the NBC Comedy Hour. So Davy Burns, to me, was the funniest. He starred as Horace Vandegelder in Hello, Dolly. He was the original with Carol Channing. I was at the opening night of Hello, Dolly, the original opening night of Hello, Dolly. And so Davy did that. He was also one of the stars of Funny Thing Happened the Way of the Form. So I would say of all the people I worked with in my life, one who I loved and who just made me laugh and who I hung out with most was Davy Burns, or David Burns, if anybody want to look him up. After that, I would have to say my two equal favorites were Jimmy Durante and Ernie Kovacs. I had the opportunity to work with Jimmy on the NBC Comedy, the NBC Comedy Hour, Colgate Comedy Hour. And then I worked with Ernie Kovacs on his morning show and his evening show, and we did a sketch together called Mr. Science, which was a spoof and parody on a show called Mr. Wizard when I was growing up. So those three, and then, of course, Perry Como, were just the nicest human beings I ever worked with in my life. And Gene Stapleton. I can't leave Gene out. But there's so many.
Did you ever have a chance to do anything with Bob Hope?
No, I never worked with Bob, and actually even never met him. It's one of the few people I could say I never met, but I did not. I was in New York until, I didn't move to California until 75. So most of the people I'm telling you about were all kind of New York-based people. It's only after I moved to California that I got to meet some of the other people I worked with, like Telly Savalas and Penny Marshall and Carol O'Connor and whoever else I worked with on television.
And what capacity
well,
did
I'm
you
sure
work
you
Penny?
Know.
Sorry?
In what
Gina?
Capacity did you work with Penny?
Well, first I worked as an actor on Laverne and Shirley. I did two episodes of Laverne and Shirley. And then I wound up the last 2 years before she passed away representing her as a director and actress. I also worked with Judd Hirsch on Taxi. I did three Taxis, and then I represented Judd for years as an actor as well. Gina, what were you going to ask me? I'm sorry.
What I was going to say is the only other story I have about actors and actresses and people from that area is Bob Hope. One of my great aunts, my dad's aunt, actually went to school in Cleveland with Bob Hope. And she sat right behind him in school. This was grade school. And she used to wear pigtails. And she used to tell us stories about how Bob Hope used to take her pigtails and dunk them in the inkwell every day at school. And she had the most incredible stories about Bob Hope. She would tell us how much he was very much like the Bob Hope you'd see on TV, even as a youngster in school.
A lot of people don't know that Bob Hope was majority or minority owner of the Cleveland Indians. I didn't realize
he was.
I didn't know
yes,
that.
Yes, he did.
He was a major, yeah, yep. He was a major partner in the Cleveland Indians back in the 40s and 50s. So.
That he was.
So I did
so
not
Ernie
know.
Hud-
I did not know him.
Yeah. Yeah, Ernie Hudson, he was another one. Was that before Ghostbusters? I've actually met him, and I actually, he had given me his cell phone number, and I remember I met him, and then I lost my phone on the airplane, and that was always my biggest regret, is that I lost his phone number. So I've been wanting to reconnect
with
him for years.
I worked with Ernie after Ghostbusters. He was sent to me by a client of mine named Beverly, at the time, Beverly Todd, a wonderful actress. Who I've known forever. She won't let me tell you how long I know her, but she was one of the most successful models in New York, and we did very well together. She starred with Whoopi Goldberg. She starred with Morgan Freeman in The Bucket List. Really wonderful actress. And Beverly introduced me to Ernie, and I worked with him for a while. But one of the people that I loved working with up until recently, and one of the reasons I'm in Atlanta, is to just a slight correction on your opening bio. We have not made the Ernie Banks movie yet. We were getting ready to make it, and then everything hit here. That's when I moved. But my client at the time, Lou Gossett Jr., who just called me while we were on this call, is going to play Ernie Banks in his latter years in the movie. So Lou and I worked together for years. We did, you know, a lot of good things together, and he's considered a real good friend.
Thank you for that correction. Yeah, and so with what does the future look like for you? Because we've got about 7 minutes, maybe only five
okay.
or six. So what's the future look like for you?
Well, I made a decision to close my management company after 43 years. I figured that was enough. And I've been asked to be one of the producers on this film that I helped in the beginning put together by bringing Lou to the project and other people. So I moved here, and we were supposed to start the movie. And then you know what happened. I mean, we're all sitting here waiting to go to work. So while I'm here, and I've literally moved here, I'm a resident here, I've been developing this other project called the Odyssey of Bobby Summers, which is a wonderful story about a young 12-year-old boy who's on a journey to correct something on his own, and it's fabulous. And now I'm developing a one-man show I'm going to direct for a friend of mine about the story of his mother's life. Brilliant. And I'm working with a new group of people in L.A. who have written 10 scripts, which I'm reading now. And I'm going to be a partner in that company and try to get them made. So I'm pretty busy right now, considering there's nobody's working. You know, I'm reading a lot.
Yeah,
but I've made a decision.
Getting caught up.
I've made a decision that I want to produce. And then I pulled out of the draw a movie I wrote 16 or 17 years ago that I've just done a polish on, that I'm going to finally put my foot to the ground on, because it's my a really important movie, and that's next. So that's what I'm up to. I'm just reading and getting ready to wait for the business to reopen so I can go find some investors and funding and get these movies made. The Ernie Banks movie is ready to go. I'm just a producer on that. That's already funded. But the other ones,
Michael,
I'm going out and looking for investments now. Yeah.
In the next month or so, I'm planning on going up to Atlanta to celebrate getting my PhD. So when I get up there, I will definitely make sure that we connect and get together.
Muzzle and PhD in what?
In entrepreneurship.
Oh, how beautiful. And where are you living now? Where do you live now, Nina?
Fort Myers, Florida.
Oh, I love Fort Myers, Florida. My very dear friends, the Walkins, Christopher and his two brothers and parents, owned a house on the Captiva.
Oh, beautiful place. Beautiful place.
Oh, yeah. Loved it. It burnt. It fell to the ground in a hurricane, but I grew up, you know, knowing about Captiva. So I love Fort Myers. So that's great. Come on up and let me know when you're coming, and we'll hang out. That'd be fabulous.
I will definitely do that.
Terrific. I hope I've been able to answer some questions for you, Andrea. And
you've been amazing, Michael.
I'm a little long in the tooth when I get – you know, these are such great memories for me. I have such a vivid memory, thank God. And I've had such extraordinary experiences that after we do the ebook, I'm going to do a documentary about my life, too. It's very, very exciting.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted you to talk a little more and explore a little more, because I could hear the stories come out, and I enjoy bringing those out of people, and I'm really glad to hear you're going to do a documentary, because that I have had a passion for documentaries since I was a young girl. I used to watch PBS all the time. And I hear such beautiful heart in these stories behind everyone. And I love who you, how you represent, like the, I love how you brought Gina often is quiet on the show. And I'm often texting her going, hey, do you want to jump in? So I love that you also encourage her to speak up, because I love her insight and her, what she has to say. And so I love that you also put her on the spot and brought her out even more, because she's amazing and awesome. And I love having her. This is actually her show, and she brought me on as an executive producer several years ago. And when her co-host had something else going on, she brought me on. So I love how you did that and brought her into it, and so she could share her beautiful story.
I'm looking forward to meeting her, and the connection with Perry Como was so beautiful that I really want to make sure that David knows that you've been talking to the guy who played him when he was 10, 11, 12 years old.
Well, I will pass that on just as soon as Bill gets home tonight.
And what I will do is I will email Andrea the picture of me and Perry and the kids, and you can forward that to his granddaughter. Okay.
I will make that happen. Absolutely. Thank you so much for that.
You're
Thank you,
welcome.
Michael, for
You're
joining us today. Do you have a website that we can go look at, or do we need to just go to the IMBD?
The best way to reach me, I never was out there trying to promote myself, because most of the business I did was in, you know, by recommendations and stuff. So I wasn't ever out soliciting for clients. People always referred. So I never just had the need to put a website together. I guess I should. But if people want to reach me at all for inquiries or stuff, not for representation, I'm not looking to represent anybody, I can give you an email address that they can email questions to me or anything about my project. All right, so let me give that to you now. It's MMM as in Michael, G as in girl, M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, 42, which is the year I was born, @gmail.com. So MMMGMT is an abbreviation for Michael Mann Management. MMMGMT42@gmail.com. And if I can be of help to anyone, or if anybody's interested in knowing about my projects, I'd be happy to communicate with them. It'd be my pleasure. Okay.
Well, Michael,
and
if I can ever help you get a website put together, we'll talk about
that
it.
That would be
great. We'll get to Atlanta in a couple weeks.
You got it. You got it. I'm looking forward to meeting you. Andrea, thank you so much for your time. I hope this was helpful. And let's communicate a little later today, okay?
Yes, and we need to give a shout out to Barry Shore. Barry Shore is the reason that we met, and he is the originator of the Keep Smiling cards and a co-founder with Ken Rashawn. I'm the executive director of the Keep Smiling movement, which allowed us to have Michael Mann here with us today on Leverage Masters with Gina Gaudio Grace.
Thank you, Barry.
And me, Andrea Adams Miller.
Right, and Barry and I have been friends. His son and my children all grew up together in Venice, California. I know him for over 40 years, and one of the true great people of all time. So I love him. I love him dearly.
He is an amazing guy. We've had him on the show before. I love Barry. So thank you so much for joining us, Michael. Thank you, Andrea, for making this happen.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And we'll be in touch real soon. Thanks for your time, ladies. Be well.
We'll be back same time, same place next week. Have a fantastic week, everybody.
Tune in next week for another episode of Leverage Masters. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook on our Leverage Black Book page to keep up with the latest. We'll see you next time on Leverage Masters.